Hello, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. On today's show, documentary filmmaker Adam Zucker talks about his new film, American Muslim. That's all coming up on Endeavors. Indecision keeps me up. There's another film festival happening in New York next week. New York already has Tribeca, but this is not that. You probably wouldn't even call it Sundance or TIFF or Cannes. In this day and age, you know, in the age of millennials and social justice, this is a film festival with a message and a social justice one at that. It's called Cinematters, the New York Social Justice Film Festival. And while most of the screenings there are documentaries, they actually do have a special presentation of Harriet, which stars Cynthia Erivo in her Golden Globe-nominated role of the iconic Harriet Tubman. Sadly, she was unavailable for this podcast. But one filmmaker I did get to talk to is Adam Zucker. He has mainly worked in the industry as an editor, including projects on the late film legend Carol Channing, as well as architect Eero Saarinen. But he has also made his own films as writer, director, and producer. His last one was called The Return, which was about Jews in Poland. And his latest film, which is screening as part of the festival, is called American Muslim. And it examines what it means to be Muslim in America in the age of Trump and follows several stories of Muslims living in Zucker's hometown of New York City. So this is my conversation with Adam Zucker about American Muslim. Adam Zucker, hello, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here today.
My pleasure, thank you.
So you have a new documentary out, American Muslim. Do you remember what the genesis of this project was for you? What was the inspiration to look at this part of America?
Well, the answer to why I made the film and what kicked it off is actually very simple. It's two words: Donald Trump. as with many people I know, I was very very upset by what was being said and done during the 2016 presidential election. And then when the election happened, I, again, like most people in my world, was just devastated, really devastated, and I really didn't know what to do. The notion that we were living in a country that would endorse such hatred and bigotry was just beyond me. Maybe I don't have much imagination, but I was just, I didn't really know what to do with it. And again, there's a lot of minorities in America, but the things that had been said specifically about Muslim Americans during the campaign was just horrifying to me. I'm Jewish. I'm a religious minority. I don't feel like, while anti-Semitism is on the rise, I don't personally feel threatened, but I was really upset that any minority could be treated that way. And a couple of days after the election, I found myself in a circle of Muslims and Jews in a shared evening that had been arranged, and hearing stories from that community, I just realized at that moment I had to do something that in some way referenced, addressed, dealt with this situation. Not that I had a solution, but I felt I had to give voice to this story. And let me be clear, I mean, the Muslim community was very, very capable of speaking for themselves. They didn't need me to come in to kind of save them. I just felt I needed, almost for my own sake, I needed to tell this story and to try to enter into it so that I could just make a contribution to this conversation I'd hoped we'd all be having. So it started, the idea of it started right after the election, and I began filming on the Women's March, which is the large multi-million person protest in D.C. the day after the inauguration of Donald Trump. That was January 21st, 2017, and then 6 days later, he issued the Muslim ban. So I didn't really know what the structure of the film would be, but that certainly gave me a strong indication I was going to have to follow this issue.
Did the election sting more for you because you are also a resident of New York, and the president is from New York?
No, we here in New York are just speaking for myself. I take no ownership of Donald Trump. He's always, I mean, I don't mean to be overly strident politically, but, you know, having been a New Yorker, he was just kind of regarded by most people as a bit of a buffoon, honestly, like as a real estate person. And no one really took him seriously. He was just a person, a blowhard, I guess was the word. I'm an American citizen. That was my point of entry. But I will say, I thought, okay, I will try to make something about Muslims in America and, and travel around. But I made this film completely on my own with zero budget. It was just coming out of pocket. So the notion of traveling anywhere where I didn't know places, that wasn't going to work logistically. And I also was very attracted to making something about my hometown and in parts of my hometown that I don't usually go to. New York City is a very big city, like Toronto or others. It's huge. And there are neighborhoods that one rarely goes to and that I didn't have a lot of entree to. So not so much for my own entertainment, it's the wrong word entirely, but it was just a way to kind of frame the story to make it more local.
Did you have any, because you then limited yourself to the Muslim population in New York City, which is the largest in the States, did you have any qualms about naming your film American Muslim as opposed to Yankee Muslim, for example, just because of the geographic area you were in?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit of a conceit. I don't mean to imply that this represents all people, and it doesn't, and it couldn't. By American Muslim, I think, what was drawn to me, one of the first people I spoke to was Kabir Chaudhry. He's in the film, he's Bengali American. And he spoke very eloquent about what it meant to be American, as many immigrants will tell you that story, you know, that they really believe in America, that is something they really strive for. And as a native and a born American, you know, I take some of those things for granted, honestly, and that's probably inevitable. So his notion of what it meant to be American, that was sort of the framing device for the film. So I meant American Muslim in that way more. How does one become American? What does it mean to be American? Which is, you know, the immigrant experience, while at the same time limiting my focus because, you know, if I were to go global or national, as the case may be, it becomes a little bit more of a overview and it's hard to get really deep anywhere because you're too busy covering a lot of territory.
I think it was Chaudhry in the film that said being a Muslim is being a good American. But it strikes me in many ways that maybe America doesn't know what America is. What is the sense you get about that?
Well, I mean, that's a good way to put it. That is what Kabir Chaudhry said, the man I was referring to, and I use that as a kickoff point for the film itself. You know, there's a lot of mythology about America, the land of the free and the democratic, leader of the free world, blah, blah, blah. And let me take that back. I don't mean blah, blah, blah. It becomes rhetoric. And for much of my life, I think it was, you know, not that we don't do terrible things here on a political level, but we have been, we, this country has been a beacon for many people. And that really is true. But with the rhetoric and policies and laws that are being passed in government now, that's just really being called into question. And that's not for me. I'm not the sociologist that can really say, what does America mean now? And frankly, everything that's going on feels very unprecedented to me. So it's a little bit hard. It's very head spinning. And, you know, it's a changing world. That's about as far as I can go in terms of analyzing what does America mean. But I really, within the film, whether someone like Imam Shamsi Ali, who's an Indonesian-American, or Kobi Chaudhry, or Debbie Almenthauser, a Yemeni-American who came here when she was 3 years old. And all these people were here coming for the American dream, and they're all American citizens now. And because of the Muslim ban, not only does that mean that if you are from one of the six selected countries, which are all Muslim-majority countries, you're not allowed into the United States, what it means is that these people who are United States citizens can't bring their family members to live with them, that they are excluded from this country. So that kind of policy is A, unprecedented, and B, I would say a lot of non-Muslim Americans aren't really aware of those facts, and I don't blame them. There's like so much going on a daily basis in my country politically that it's kind of hard to stay focused, and it's hard to keep everything, all those balls in the air of what's happening.
When I was watching the film, I got the sense that if you look at, you know, the history of America, at least within the last 300 years, does it feel like maybe Muslims are the latest scapegoat by the white government? By that I mean, first it was the Native Americans that they persecuted, then there was, you know, the blacks and the Jews and the Japanese, and it feels like maybe the Muslims are the next race or the next culture to be victimized by that. What do you agree with that at all?
Well, I might more or less agree with that, but I'm a little wary about talking about things that aren't really my
fair
field of expertise. I'm a storyteller, and as a person, as an individual, yes, I do believe that Muslims are being scapegoated because they are the other. And at this point in time, and it ties into horrible fears about terrorism that are mostly completely unfounded. But what also happens in this country, and this is a statistical fact, most non-Muslims have never met a Muslim person. And there's about 3 million Muslims in America. There's about 3 million Jews. I think there's about 6 million Jews. Don't quote me on either situation there. I might be wrong by a factor of two. But the point is that within a country of 350 million people, we're both religious minorities. And many people have never met a Muslim. And there are many people within the Muslim community, and in terms of like the advocacy people of how do you change people's minds, it's to get to know people. You know, you can't vilify someone when you know them, when they live next door to you, when they're actually nice people. And they are nice people, you know. And, you know, the whole range of human emotion. So, yes, people who are going to be fearful, who are going to be xenophobic, those are the people that are now being targeted. And honestly, for, you know, besides telling this political story, what I really wanted to do was just to open a window into a world that not enough people knew about or would hopefully kind of humanize them. And let me just say, that's a terrible word. It makes it sound like they need to be humanized. No one in my film needed, they didn't need to be humanized, because they needed that story to be presented to other people who weren't aware of it.
I want to pick up on that, because I think it was Isman Ali, the man from Indonesia, who talks about being conversation and opening a dialogue about understanding religion, not just Islam, but, you know, like his neighbor was an Irish Catholic. Is that part of the divide that we're seeing today? Is that people aren't as understanding of each other and other cultures?
Well, I live in New York City, which is, I assume, the most diverse city in the country. I don't know that scientifically, but I assume it has to be. So there's a lot of, you know, a lot of cultures that live here. You know, New York City is divided into five boroughs, one of which is Queens, which is where I grew up a long time ago. And I believe that Queens has 130 languages that are spoken. And I'm grabbing that number out of thin air. It's ballpark. And they say that for a county in America, there's more languages spoken there, native languages, than any, you know, than anywhere else. So it's attractive to say that people can't be vilified and they're xenophobic because they don't know their neighbors. But I think that's a little bit of a convenience to kind of latch on to that. I mean, the fact of the matter is there's a lot of stories about places in the middle of the country that would seem to be a little bit more homogenous, where there have been strong statements of solidarity and support of, you know, the Somali small business owner who's been there for like 20 years, who has been a significant member of the community. When he's been kind of targeted, a lot of people stood up for him. And I could come up with other stories that are not apocryphal that are true. But again, I'm always a little wary of, like, how do you tie together all these disparate instances? I'm not a journalist that would say, this country is now more racist than it used to be, or is now less racist than it used to be. I don't know how you make those determinations, and there's sociologists who will do those surveys and all. I just find, I would like to think, and I do think it's true, that within this really bad period of scapegoating and targeting and vilifying, that it's actually an opportunity for people to get to know each other better and for people to work together more. And on that front, in terms of interfaith alliance and community alliance, it is sort of a golden period, and I do hope that it will continue to grow and that, you know, it'll become a better society. And mind you, you know, I can't talk about the United States as a whole, which is what I'm doing, and I certainly wouldn't pretend to do that with other countries, but I would expect that a lot of these issues are human being issues, and, you know, there's a lot of right-wing populist governments around the world with a lot of consequences, so there are no doubt certain parallels, but we'll just leave it with my own country.
I believe it was Debbie in the film that brought up 9/11, and that's sort of what made her an activist. And you're obviously from New York. What was the impact that 9/11 had not only on New York, but, you know, around this conversation of, you know, immigration, diversity, and particularly for the Muslim population in New York?
Well, I am a New Yorker. I lived here in 2001. I was about a mile from 9/11. And I was not, while I do have friends who lived much closer who had to be evacuated, and some of whom never returned to their homes because they were either contaminated or they were traumatized. But it had no direct impact like that on me, and I do know a handful of people indirectly who died that day. When I set out to make a movie, I don't really know where it's going, and what I do is I talk to a lot of people, and more properly, I listened to a lot of people. And it wasn't Dr. Debbie, it was someone else who originally told me, one of the first people I was just having a conversation with on a formal level, who said, you have to understand, after 9/11, the Muslim population and Arab American and Sikhs, who of course have nothing to do with anything, but they wear turbans, so that's really absurd. But the point being, all those people were very much on the front line. And I knew that, but I didn't realize, and this has been corroborated by various people, so I feel comfortable saying it, that in general, a lot of people in the Muslim and Arab American communities were not pushing back, were kind of hunkering down, hoping this unprecedented apocalyptic reaction, of which they were not responsible in any way whatsoever, would pass over, and they can go back to things being normal. And I believe now, and again, this is what everyone says, like 17, 18 years later, this is often referred to, the election of Trump, as the second 9/11, and this time people are not taking it lying down. And whether it's via interfaith alliance or whether it's through, you know, deliberate pushback by Muslim communities themselves, it is a totally different reaction. So within those communities, yeah, there was a lot of targeting within the immigrant communities. Abir Kawas, the Palestinian American woman in the film, talks about her father was apprehended and was held in detention for 3 years. I believe he was in the process of trying to get a green card. And the lawyers eventually said to the family, he's not going to get released. I mean, you can fight this, but we can't guarantee this is ever going to work out. And he self-deported, as they call it. He chose to go back to Jordan. And that was 19 years ago, and he's still in Jordan. He can't come back to this country. So that's the consequence of 9/11, and that's the consequence of saying that this terrible tragedy, which was perpetrated by 20 people, 19 people, what have you, that were, you know, under Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, you know, who have nothing to do with the lives of normal Arab American and Muslim American people. That's the aftermath of that action. And it's still being felt today in various ways.
There's a couple people in the film, you know, that mention people's associations between being Muslim and being Arab, even though Ismaili says most Muslims are non-Arab. How important was it for you to include that wide swath of Muslims? Like you said, you talked to somebody from Yemen, you've got Palestine, you've got Indonesia, Bengali. Was that conscious on your part?
It was conscious on my part. When I started this film, and I'm not patting myself on the back, I would say I knew more about Islam than most non-Muslims, only because I read and I'm interested in religion. But I didn't really have any Muslim friends. I'm embarrassed to admit that, but that's true. So I don't pride myself on being, like, so enlightened. But I did know that Indonesian is the largest Muslim population in the world. I did know the Arab American world. While the Middle East is where Islam happened and grew from what is now Saudi Arabia, but it doesn't make up the mainstay of the Muslim population. Most of that is actually in Far Asia right now. And in the United States, it was very important to me that to try to break down that very false myth that all Arabs are Muslims and all Muslims are Arabs. The fact of the matter is, in the United States, not worldwide, but in the United States, most Arab Americans are Christian. And I didn't know that. Statistically, I didn't realize it was 60%, I believe, is the number. So because of all that information, I knew I wanted to have a kind of range of individuals, and I wanted to have a range of communities. And that being the case, it would have been ridiculous to make this film without someone representing the South Asian community, whether that's Bangladesh or Pakistan or Malaysia, which is not South Asia, and Indonesia. Those places had to be represented. And I would also say, as a poke at myself, I probably should have had somebody who was from the African-American Muslim community, because that's also fairly large. It just didn't work out, and I wasn't trying to check off the boxes, but it was important that there be a range of individuals so they wouldn't get a sense that it is a monolithic community. And someone like Imam Shamsi Ali, that's very, very important to him. That's sort of his goal, is for people to understand the breadth, diversity, and range of the Muslim community in the United States and worldwide. So I wanted to give voice to that, and if I didn't, I really wouldn't have been doing the story justice.
Was it easy to get people to talk? You know, because I've talked with a lot of documentary filmmakers in the past who their subjects can be kind of wary of appearing on camera. What was the process like for you?
Well, how it was for me was wonderful. It's honestly the most fun part of my job. It is not a job, but the most fun part of my task is to get to call people up and say, you know, so-and-so suggested I speak to you and I'm a documentary filmmaker. Could we get together and talk? And most people are usually happy to talk. And it gives me an opportunity to, like, listen to people. You know, I buy them tea or whatever, and we hang out. And it's fascinating, absolutely fascinating, before I get to the point of how it's all going to become a story. And as to how I find the individuals, it's really just an organic process of like any other journalist. You try to, you know, someone introduces you to A, and A suggests, oh, by the way, you might want to speak to B and C and all that. And then I don't try to cast. That is, I don't try to say, okay, I need to have a man who's, you know, like in middle age. I need to have a young woman. I need to have an older imam. I kind of just go a little bit more casually of people that attract me. And some people that I start filming with don't end up in the film. But in terms of getting people to agree to meet with me or to be filmed, that was actually easier than I would have thought. And I think it's partially, again, this is not a monolithic reaction. Not everybody's the same, but many, many people said to me, I'm really glad you're doing this. You, Adam Zucker, outsider, Jewish, non-Muslim American, I'm really glad you're coming here to talk with us because really we need to do more of this. We have been targeted because people don't know who we are, and we haven't done a really good enough job and made it a priority to kind of open our doors. And again, some people may not feel that way, but many, many people did tell me that. So in that sense, it was an opportunity to meet people. You know, you can go to any mosque, not any, but you can go to most mosques. And if you're respectful and, you know, a nice person, they'll be happy to show you around and answer questions, even if they're, you know, naive questions. I think people realize it's in their best interest. As to people allowing me to film with them today, next week, next month, the month after that, that's usually a harder sell. And I've done other films that are actually more about that, more about the narrative life arc of the individual, where I really spent a lot of time with them. And duplicitous or not, I never say, can we do that? Can I film you every month for the next 3 years? Because the answer would be no. So I just kind of try to get people to trust me and hope they'll be open to the process. And with this film, that's what it generally was. People would say, wow, this guy keeps on coming back. And showing up is a lot of what it's about. You know, you keep on showing up, and respectfully, I mean, I don't stick microphones in people's faces and demand answers. I'm trying to embed myself in the community as an outsider. You know, embed is the wrong word. Just trying to make people comfortable with me. They tend to come around, and if they choose not to, and if they choose to stop filming or say, you know, I won't sign a release, I can't use them in the film. I do want people to feel like they're partners or collaborators, even though I have the right, once they sign a release, to do whatever I want. But I do take that trust seriously. I do show them the film when it's almost done to see if there's anything that they may be unhappy with so we can talk about it and see what to do, which could be nothing. So I just try to be honest to myself, which is that I do, in fact, like these people, and I do want to tell their stories and try to earn their trust from that place.
You know, when I visited New York, I was struck by how nice and hospitable everyone was. And, you know, when he talked about, you know, going to the mosque and being let in, how much of that is just the New York way of life?
It's hard for me to answer that. I mean, I am a New Yorker and I have lived here my whole life, and I do go to a lot of different places. I think the stereotype that New Yorkers are rude, which is not, it's nice of you to say otherwise. I think it's just the people here are busy. But since I haven't really made it a point to try to make inroads into Muslim communities while filming, I have no point of comparison. I don't know. You know, I'm a member of a synagogue, and as it is, we don't have a permanent building. But projecting that we did, we would be open to people coming in while a little wary, just because security being what it is. But we're certainly, every faith group I would like to think is open to having other people come in their doors, not to convert them, but just to kind of still get to know them better. So we're open to everyone. And I don't think that's in the New York or an American thing. I would think that's just a faith community thing. But I don't know the answer.
You made a decision, I noticed, not to appear on camera at all. I know documentary filmmakers who do regularly in their films or not at all. Was that always the plan for you, just to be, you know, completely removed and this outsider and tell their story and not inject yourself into it?
Well, that's a good question, because I'm sensitive to the fact that I'm telling the story of another community. And I think it's a very valid question. What do I bring to the table, and how dare, not so much how dare I, although, you know, I might encounter that to some degree. And I can say categorically, now that the film's finished, when I show it in Muslim American audiences, I can't swear that everybody loves the movie. It's not for me to say that or know that, but no one has said, who are you? What right do you have to do this? No one. They all say, wow, it's really great that you, an outsider, came to do this and did a respectful job. But at first, ironically, because I've never done this before, and I've made a number of films, at first the film started with my voice off camera, reading from my journal entries right after the election, and telling the story of how why I was making this film. And I wanted that in there. I didn't want to make a first-person film because I don't really think my story is that interesting. And I don't think it's that alluring to tell the story of, say, a Jew trying to find Muslims. I mean, that's just not, that's the trope. I'm not attracted to that. But I did want to kind of get it off the table, like, who is this person? And a couple of times during filming, I left my questions in, not so much where were you born, but what do you think about this or what do you think about that? Because I wanted my POV to be there. But eventually that stuff kind of worked its way out. I felt it was less essential and I was willing to take the risk of being misunderstood, perhaps, of why am I making the film. And I'm an editor. I edit a lot of documentaries, a lot of feature docs. And there are some people who are honestly a bit narcissistic who like to make first-person films. And there's other people that are like me, probably not narcissistic, and go into it kicking and screaming because they realize their point of entry is really the only way to understand the story. I would be very resistant to putting myself into the film, and I try to a degree in this case as I never have before, but it got removed. So it wasn't really a question. I played with it and struggled with it for a while, but ultimately I felt my being there took too many people out of the story as opposed to the number of people that it illuminated by being in the story, so that's why I'm not in it.
But I wanted to touch on something that it happens towards the end of the film when you see there's a Jewish synagogue, like, and I'm sorry, I forget the rabbi's name, but that stands outside the mosque and shows support. How important was that for you to include, not only as a filmmaker, but as a Jewish person as well?
Well, that's a good question. The group Congregation Beit Simchat Torah, which is an LGBTQ-based synagogue, has been going to the ICNYU, the Islamic Center at NYU University, ever since the election, and still are there now today, and they're wonderful people and a wonderful congregation. As a Jewish person, I was resistant to using that scene because I didn't want it to come across of Jews feeling good about themselves and being promotional, and not so much the people who are doing it, who are very non-self-promotional, but my inclusion of that in the story. It did become clear that Interfaith Alliance was a big thing, and I really wanted somehow or other that to become evident. And it seemed like the group at CBST, despite my resistance or my cringe, I didn't want anyone to cringe in watching it, what weighed in its favor of why it had to be in the film is that all the people, or many, many people who go to ICNYU, told me that they were really moved that these people were here. And it's probably important to recognize that the Islamic Center is part of a major university in Greenwich Village in New York. I honestly don't think anyone there feels threatened if those people weren't there. That's not quite the point. It's not like they're going to Iowa to a mosque that feels under siege and are really offering support there. But it's in their community. I'm not in any way ragging on them for why don't they travel 1,000 miles. It makes a lot of sense for them to go there. And they have very close relationships now, that mosque, that Islamic center, and that congregation. So I did want to give voice to the fact that Interfaith Alliance is on the rise. There's many, many examples of it. And this just seemed like a better way to tell the story because it was very human being based and individually based as opposed to, organizations that are doing advocacy work. That's not that compelling to me. I think it's very, very important, but it's of a different energy. So that's why it ended up in the film. And I don't think I was doing it to feel good about myself, about the Jewish community. I was doing it because I really do think it's important for people to understand that there is a lot of solidarity. And many, many people in the Muslim community would share that fact, because they do. They tell me that all the time.
I particularly enjoyed it, actually, interestingly enough, because, as you mentioned, it's an LGBTQ synagogue, and I still think there's a lot of maybe misconceptions about the Muslim and Islamic community, that they're very, anti-LGBTQ as a whole. Did that weigh on you as you were shooting this scene at all, what that impact might be, however minor?
Well, there obviously are gay Muslims, and there obviously are gay Jews, and there obviously are people in both those communities who are very, have a lot of issues with that. There was a scene while I was filming with Sharon Kleinbaum, who's an amazing woman. She's the head of that congregation and does terrific work all over, where a Muslim person from my CNYU was arguing, and I got, they were discussing, arguing may be a better word, though, about, you know, homosexual issues. And I really felt it was a sidebar to what I was trying to do to include that. It wasn't, the goal wasn't necessarily to be inclusive about every identity issue that one could bring up, because I just felt like it wasn't the main thrust, and I didn't want to include it just to be kind of check off all the boxes of different communities. So I guess I'm not the person that could speak about gay issues or gay identity within the Muslim community. Many people have spoken about it, but I'm not the person to do that.
What I found fascinating about this movie is that it's ostensibly about politics, you know, this community after the Muslim ban, and yet politics almost takes a back seat to the actual people that you're profiling. How early on or late on in the filmmaking process did you find that tone?
That's a really good question. I make films about people. That's what I do. I that's what I'm connected to. That's what I feel affinity to. That's what gives me enjoyment. That's not the right word exactly, as much as I find gratifying and I feel like I can. That's my point of entry into storytelling. In this case, there was obviously a big issue going on, and which I also wanted to cover. So I wanted to cover the Muslim ban as it affected people's lives, and in order to do that, I felt I had to tell the story of their lives. So pretty early on, it became clear to me I wanted to do both. And that was the challenge, with how to keep both those balls in the air. I went to a lot of rallies and protests, and ultimately they sort of begin to cancel each other out as film storytelling. You know, they do all feel the same, which doesn't mean that they're not valid as protest or as making a statement, but in terms of including them in my story, they weren't pushing the story forward. What was pushing the story forward were the individuals. So it became clear to me that was my big storytelling challenge here, was how to be able to have the film do both things, and I'm pretty happy with the results of that, of how it came across.
There was one scene that I noticed where they were, it was for the election of that Arab municipal election that involved the Arab gentleman, and there was a scene where they were, the children are helping out, and I've talked to some people in the past who are perhaps wary of getting very young kids involved in activist causes, I guess I could say. As a filmmaker, did you have any qualms about that scene? Because you're filming these very young kids who aren't necessarily directly involved in these issues, but are sort of there as a consequence of other people.
Right. Well, I would say, first of all, I believe you're asking really terrific questions. I believe you're conflating two different storylines here. So just to parse it out, Father Khader El-Yatim, who was running for city council, I don't recall there being any children involved in that effort. In the Yemeni American community, there is a scene which took place on Christmas night where they're in the community center, right, and they're all making signs which are going to be used at a protest a day later, by the Yemeni American community against the Muslim ban. And a lot of children are both making signs that day and the next day, I believe it was the next day, maybe it was 2 days later, forgive me, who were holding signs like, I need my mom, bring my father back, I miss my father. And, you know, hearing you ask the question, I sort of agree. They are being used, I wouldn't say as props, that's a little demeaning, but it is a very powerful signal. On the other hand, it's very real. I'm not saying all the children that are holding a sign saying, I miss my mom, are literally people whose mothers are not allowed to be here. But there are many people in the Yemeni American community whose family members can't be here. And Yemen is a humanitarian disaster, probably the worst humanitarian disaster on earth, although I don't really want to draw comparisons, but it's a terrible, war-torn country that because of the Muslim ban, people can't leave from. People that are in danger can't leave. So there's many people who can't be here with their parents or vice versa. So for me, I didn't have any ethical problem of filming what they were staging. I thought it was a very powerful rally and giving voice to the family separation. I think family separation is, it's one of those lines in the sand. I mean, I'm going from one thing to another here, but You know, American policy is separating families at the border so that the children will be sequestered and it will hurt their family. That's inhumane. That just can't happen. How can you do that to five-year-old children? So that's a different issue that they were protesting, but it's the same. It's in the same ball of wax, and I have no resistance to including that in the film, and I'm glad that they had them there at the rally because they made a really great point and a really great image.
When I typically watch a documentary film, most of the time I notice that the subject or the people tell the story. But one thing that I actually did notice in your film was the score. It very subtle, but it stood out for me. And by Paul Brill, I believe is the gentleman's name was. How do you work with your collaborators behind the scenes, in this case your composer, to create the feel that you want, especially when telling a story such as this one?
That's a wonderful question. Paul Brill is someone that has become a good friend of mine, but he's much more important than that, is a really trusted collaborator. And we worked together on a film I made 5 years ago called The Return, about young Jews in Poland today dealing with their identity. And I'm an editor of documentaries. I've edited dozens of films. I've worked with dozens of, whether or not I've worked with dozens of different composers, we've scored a lot of films with different people. And working with Paul, who I think is a really terrific artist and really understands story, the great joy is letting him have free rein and then beginning a dialogue of how to shape that better. And the more time I can give him, the more he brings to the table. And it's, as a filmmaker, music is really, really important. And you don't want to be hitting people over the head with it. On the other hand, you do want to kind of create a separate parallel story that the music is carrying forward. And a lot of it is, it's a certain kind of, well, it's all artistry, but a lot of it is alchemy. I don't really know how it works. And when I chose to work again with Paul, and we've worked on maybe four or five projects now, but only two of my own personal projects. I said, you know, I use a lot of temporary music here. I'll tell you what I like, what I don't like, but I hope you're just going to throw it out and probably never listen to it. I don't know what I hear for this film, but I will know what I like and what I don't like. And it's a joy to work together, which doesn't mean it's always easy. But Paul is an artist, and he's an artist at scoring films, so I'm really pleased and will tell him that you responded to the score in the film, because I'm really proud of it also.
Just as an editor and as a storyteller, what does music do for you in terms of enhancing the story you're telling or whatever message it is that you're trying to get across?
Well, it's a little hard to put my finger on it. I mean, to be honest, on one level, a lot of scoring is actually structuring, and it's a lot of helping people to understand when a scene is over, when the next one begins. But that's just mechanics. I mean, that's all the score does. That's television. You know, they need to throw a lot of music in, so it'll just kind of help you watch it move forward. It's more a matter of creating mood and underscoring, which is where the word score comes from, the emotional content and the identity issues that the people are reflecting there. And then you have maybe a couple of themes, and they repeat themselves in ways you don't necessarily recognize, but you know that it's reminiscent because you've heard it before. And I'm a little inarticulate about this, because it's one of those processes that you have a sense of what you're going for and you don't know exactly how to go about doing it. And when it's working, you have a real sense of it. And having worked on a lot of films now, there are some times when I feel that the music is too heavy-handed. And the classic story, which is in feature movies, but it's the same thing, is Bette Davis in some film was walking up the stairway. She was going to turn when she got to the top and look back on the people who she was walking away from. And allegedly, the story goes that Betty Davis said in critiquing the movie, the music got to the top of the stairs before I did. And I kind of hold on to that as a mantra, not literally that instance, but the notion of the music helping to move the film forward, but not jumping ahead of it and not telegraphing what it's doing. You should sort of feel that it's there, and in thinking about it, realize that it was a really valuable asset, but not dominating, but also not being timid and kind of stepping back.
You've made a film about Muslims in America. You mentioned that you made a film about the Jewish population in Poland. Are you wary of being considered or pigeonholed a religious storyteller at all?
That's a good question. For a long time, I was. That is after the film about Poland, which was, I'm Jewish. I do belong to the synagogue, so I am a person of faith. I'm not that observant, more than some, less than others. But Judaism has always been very important to me. And when I chose to tell a Jewish story, I was disappointed at first and upset to think that it was getting ghettoized, so to speak, within the Jewish world and not seen as just a story. But the reality at the end of the day is that with any kind of piece of media, you do want to kind of work to your target audience. It's the people that will be particularly interested. And faith, I don't want to say so much that faith means a lot to me, because that's not the point. The point is, I think it is an important identity issue, and I do think it's an important cohesive element to these communities. And probably my interest in the Muslim story was because of my connection to Judaism and my connection to being part of a religious community, although we're not that religious. So at this point in my life, ironically, Paul Brill always jokes that I'm going to make a Christian story. And every now and then he sends me an example. Oh, did you see this in the paper about this Catholic group or this Episcopal group? And I say, Paul, I'm not doing that. The reality is, if it happens, it happens. I don't try to set out ahead of time what it'll be. And I do think faith can be a force for good. I'm not sure if organized religion is a force for good, so I have no problem with being seen within that context. And now, with this film, I do think that being someone who's not of that community, there's a lot that I can do and I am doing in interfaith groups that being an outsider is very valuable for. So I used to lose sleep over whether I was going to be identified or pigeonholed as a filmmaker of religious subjects, but I'm not concerned anymore. I just do the stories I want to do, and if that's what happens, so be it.
Given everything that's happened with your government recently, with the impeachment vote and Iran and Iraq and all that, what is the mood and the conversation like in New York City right now?
I'll preface it by saying where I'm coming from, and I think that not just Donald Trump, but the Republican Party in this country is a very dangerous, dangerous thing that's causing serious damage, perhaps permanent, to this country and to the world. To have a political party in place that doesn't believe in climate change or the consequences of climate change is so unethical and such an abomination that I have strong feelings. Part of the challenge of being a thinking person and a feeling person in this era is that there are so many things coming out of the White House. All the examples that you just gave, that's what becomes the front page. And yet, what happened 2 months ago, or to use a larger term example, the Muslim ban, is critically important. Or the series of tax cuts that are driving up the public debt to the point that, come the next 10 years, it's going to be an absolute disaster coming down the line. It's hard to stay on top of everything. So when the question is, what's the sentiment on the street, which I can't answer, but what's the sentiment in my world, which I can answer, of the various range of policies coming back, it's dizzying. It's dizzying, and the challenge is how to still keep your backbone of, and how never to lose sight of the fact of what's going on. And I do believe, it's not a big reach to think that Iran and the activities there were done as a camouflage to change the focus and the conversation from the impeachment. And when you're someone that's always lying, you have no credibility. He has no credibility. So it's a hard time be alive, and I'm not saying that as in woe is me personally. It's more woe is us. And there's an election in this country 10 months from now, and if to due to the current state of politics and the Electoral College and the way presidents are elected. If it was a one-person, one-vote election, it's clear that Trump would lose. And that's statistically not very much of a question, but that's not the way elections happen here. So if Donald Trump were reelected, words fail me as to what the consequence would be. I mean, just on the climate, which is not just, it's the most important issue. So in my world, people are, it's head spinning, and you also want to be a human being and live a life and love people and do things and still enjoy the world that's around you. So it's hard to do both those things at the same time. So that's the challenge.
So we'll end on this then. Do you think there's hope going forward?
Yes. Well, I hope nobody looks to me as the barometer of whether or not there's hope in this world. But yes, if you ask me the question, yes, I do. I do have a hopeful look at the world. I do. You know, I have my great aunt used to say, when terrible things happen, good things will come out of it. So on the smallest level, these days, all the terrible things that are happening for Muslims, it's a great opportunity for interfaith alliance, and that is happening. And I would like to think, and I do think, that there's hope for what's going on. But money interests and the Republican Party and the courts that are now being stacked, it's a lot we're up against, but if one didn't have hope, it would be really hard to get out of bed every morning, and I do. And that's where I'm coming from, that everybody has to make their own decision. I would put as a word of caution, all these things are just my opinion. I'm just another person. I'm another American. I'm another filmmaker. But trying to get a story across, and I'm usually a little wary of weighing in on a lot of issues that I'm not a spokesperson for. But since you asked, I'm happy to answer.
Well, the film is American Muslim, and it is screening as part of Cinematters, the New York Social Justice Film Festival, which takes place between January 16th and 20th, in time for Martin Luther King Day. Adam Zucker, thanks so much for your time this afternoon.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Alrighty, have a good day. Cheers. And that was my conversation with filmmaker Adam Zucker. His new documentary, American Muslim, screens as part of Cinematters, the New York Social Justice Film Festival, which runs January 16th through 20th. That does it for me today. Be sure to tune next week. We'll have another filmmaker from Cinematters, Jacqueline Olive, who will talk about her documentary, Always in Season. As well, in the future, we have an interview with Mike Reno from the iconic Canadian band Loverboy. Thanks for tuning in, and we will see you next time. Bye for now.
Artists like to have a lot of sex.